What's up, guys? This is Uriah Faber, the California Kid, here with Greg Conley, serial entrepreneur, founder of Trifecta Nutrition. We're talking about everything under the sun, fitness, entertainment, and of course, business, making that money. All right, what's up, everybody? Uriah here, the Cali Cast. Thanks for tuning in. Today, I have our very special guest, a teammate of mine and a friend, and a very interesting story to boot. This is the one, the only Sarah McMahon. What's up, Sarah?
Hey, what's going on?
Just chilling. We're out here at my casa, and we're going to have Sarah on a couple different times. She's got all sorts of good insight and stuff to talk about, and I just started getting a little bit of your backstory. For those who don't know about Sarah McMahon, she's an Olympian for US of A, our amazing country that we have here, and that in itself is really cool. Female wrestling, was it the first year ever that they had the Olympics for... for wrestling for women?
Yep. That's the inaugural year.
The inaugural year.
It's a tough one to say.
Yeah, that is a tough one to say. Let me hold this thing a little bit closer here.
Okay.
Might just hold it. Microphone check. There we go.
Is that better?
I think so, yeah. That works better.
Okay.
So, you were one of the, I mean, I guess basically made history being an Olympic wrestler. And how'd that go for you?
Got a silver medal. So
silver medal.
Bittersweet.
Bittersweet. I mean, that's better than the medal I got in the Olympics, which doesn't exist. But so that's awesome. So what year was that?
2004.
2004. And they must have made a massive deal about that. I know that you had talked about some of the injuries that you had leading into that and how that, like, they were super cautious because they didn't want to taint the first ever female wrestling thing, if you were to get some serious injury, neck spine injury, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But how cool is that, being not only in the Olympics but the first ever for a given sport? What was that like?
So, like, looking back, it's super cool, and it's like anyone who's, you know, competed at like the highest level, and especially it only being every 4 years, there's just like a tremendous amount of like intensity surrounding it. Like, I had made other world teams, but I have never experienced, even to this day, the amount of pressure that I felt the moment I made the Olympic team.
Right.
So for like 2.5 months until we competed in the Olympics, I felt more pressure and like literally the weight of the world on my shoulders. It was like really, really tough.
That's crazy. I mean, yeah, that's one thing, I guess. There's a lot of people kind of going through the same thing on the Olympic level. Ton of kids that train since they're very little just to have the opportunity to step foot on that competition level. And I can imagine there's a lot of pressure there, but it's also got to be kind of surreal, you know, being touted as somebody who's representing a country that's in such an iconic situation for you know, the Olympics, however long they've been going. You know how long they've been going? We're going to have to Google this.
Yeah, we're going to have to Google it. I'm not sure, but I do know that wrestling and track were the first two Olympic sports.
Wow.
So.
That's cool.
Yeah, it is.
Nice. So what was that process like? How early did you have to go to the actual site of the Olympics? I mean, what was the month looking like when it was time to compete?
So we competed towards the end of the games, and so it is about a month-long process. And we got there a little before opening ceremonies. We didn't stay in the Olympic Village. We stayed in a hotel outside of it there was a college, it was like American College, and so we trained there, and we stayed in hotels pretty close by. I had a teammate, Patricia Miranda, that had motion sickness, so we would have had to drive an hour there, an hour back, and do that twice a day, and she just wouldn't have been able to get training because she would have been sick the entire time. So they kept us out of the village until after we competed. But no, it was it's really crazy. We visited the Olympic Village a lot, and the amount of like intensity and stress, like everybody's there. You know, a lot of sports you can only compete in one Olympics. Like either you just hit your prime, and or you know, like if you're a gymnast, the odds of doing two Olympics is pretty slim. There's a lot of sports that are like that. Whereas maybe, you know, some other sports, like maybe like the longer distances and stuff, maybe you can hit several Olympic cycles, or, you know, swimmers are able to do several Olympics. You know, for wrestling, it's very tough to make a couple of Olympic teams.
Right.
You know,
like, no, it's competitive as hell, and
yeah,
I mean, it's a grind on the body, etc.
Like four more years of putting yourself through that is tough.
Yeah. I know we were at your last fight, and the Olympics were on, the Winter Olympics, and we were watching some, what was the event? It was like curling or something, right?
I think it was curling.
Where these women, where they like push a
different
cylinder on like a slate of ice, like into a bullseye, and they have a team that like is like brushing ice and scrubbing ice in front of it to like get it into the to the spot, and I'm thinking, you know, it's crazy some of the sports that they have. I mean, wrestling is real basic.
Yeah.
It's humans trying to force somebody to do something they don't want to do by pinning them or by taking them down when they want to get taken down, etc. It's a form of battle and war. And I was thinking, like, most sports are like a form of battle or war.
Yeah.
You know, and I was looking at that in particular, like, what did that mean on like the survival scale of like human race? If there's a curling, I mean, I guess it would be like, I don't know, maybe some sort of hunting skill or something like that. Like,
yeah.
Swimming, you can swim away from an animal, or you can catch something in the water. You can travel to new places. Wrestling, you can fight for food, women, or water. Food, women, or territory.
Yeah.
Protect your young. Track.
Even running. I learned that a long time ago, humans used to outrun animals. So, like, we would run them down over several days. We'd chase them down day and night. So running had, like, a tremendous value for surviving because eventually they get exhausted and die.
Right.
Like, whereas we could continue to run. So.
Yeah, and you look at football. Like, say, football. Football is actually war. It's like, yeah, you have someone in charge. You have coaches that are telling you what to do. You have a lead guy who's the quarterback. You have everyone that's serving this purpose, and you're trying to invade someone's territory, you know, against their will.
Working cohesively.
Yeah, working cohesively. Yeah. You know, everything's... You know, these sports, baseball, same thing,
yeah.
Basketball,
archery. Yeah.
It's kind of crazy. So it always baffles me when I see some sports where I'm like, what, how did that become something that somebody had to get good at? What was the actual purpose? And why now do we give a shit?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I thought that we had the same year that we were in. There was an exhibition sport. It was speed walking, you know?
Yeah.
Which,
I saw that too.
Along that lines, I didn't understand it because I was like, why wouldn't it just be running? Like, and I'm not trying to like knock any other sports.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to talk about this without getting some haters out there.
Yeah. Well, but I just don't understand, like you were saying, the value of some sports that, you know, where that evolved in human evolution to be of value.
Exactly.
You know? Because superior to that would be running.
Right.
You know, like.
Yeah, it's like a fast walker. What does that mean exactly in the real world? Like,
yeah,
you're definitely going to get eaten before the guy that can run faster than you,
yes.
You know? And, yeah, so it's whenever I think about those sports, I'm like, I feel like we should take it back to like a, like we should be able to make sense of it. And there probably is some sort of sense. Like there might be, especially in a culture where that was real popular, like the curling or whatever,
yeah,
that might have been a valuable thing to,
yeah,
be able to.
And we just don't know why.
We don't know why yet. I like to do like a, I wonder if there's like a history of, I'm going to have to Google that also.
Yeah.
But anyway, so you took a silver medal in the Olympics, which I know you're a sore loser. I've seen it firsthand.
I am.
So what was the emotion like for winning the medal? Were you like, wow, I got a silver medal in the Olympics? Were you disappointed because you didn't get the gold? How did it go down? Did you feel like you got ripped off? Like, was there politics involved? What was the story of the final tournament?
So in my final match, I don't really like, I don't ever try to like look back and be like, oh, this ref screwed me over. This, you know, this happened, you know, but, I think that there was definitely some ambiguity of the points. So
right.
I was winning 2-0 going into the second period. It was 2 3-minute periods then. And basically the rule set then was if you didn't have 3 points, you were going to be forced into go into overtime.
Right.
And so I didn't have 3 points yet. So I had to keep wrestling offensively, you know,
right,
and open myself up to attack. There was a scramble that, you know, she's the reigning world champion. And so we got into like this scramble where I, you know, my coaches argued that I had a solid back exposure. In freestyle, if you break 90 degrees, that's 2 points automatically, you know? And they gave me 1 point for it. And I even have like, you know, there's different photos of the scramble, like slowed down and stuff like that. And somebody asked me to sign it and I wrote 2 fucking points, Sarah McMahon, you know, like, but either way, people are human. You know, we have human referees. So, but I would have probably wrestled differently if I had attained the 3 points, but you know what? Maybe she still would have tied it up at 3 and I would have gone to overtime. And you know, like you can't tell how things would have gone, but I lost the match 3-2 to, you know, she is now like one of the best wrestlers in women's history. She won 4 gold medals.
So, wow. Yeah. That's impressive.
Yeah. So, and she'd been wrestling since she was 3 years old. So who knows how things would have gone. Immediately following the match, man, I was like, I kind of like stayed a little bit detached. But they gave me like 1 minute where I could walk back off the mat and I saw my coach. And as soon as I saw my coach and like him and I met eyes, I just burst into tears. Like I couldn't hold it back anymore. I was like boo-hooing and snotting all over the place. I'm an ugly crier. I'll admit it. I am. It's bad. So, and then like a minute later, they're like, you guys, you have to go back out there and go immediately to the award ceremony, you know?
Yeah.
So the bronze medalist, they are someone who was possibly out of medal contention at all, wrestled and won several hours earlier. So they're waiting to stand up there and receive their bronze medal. They're quite a bit happier. The silver medalist and the gold medalist are, this is immediately following the match. So there's pictures of me like, you know, bawling on the Olympic stand. I wasn't bawling. I was trying to hold it in. But
you come to terms with this now. This isn't like Ace Ventura Pet Detective laces out, like no. Change your gender and stalk people down or anything like that.
No, no. Okay, actually, good. Really quickly, I came to terms with it because like I had to go and still do interviews because I was like the only women. I was the highest medaler, you know, like for women's wrestling. So I was the only person who had a silver medal in the Olympics for women's wrestling.
Right.
So I had to go to different places later that night for interviews. And it was, this was the same night that I, you know, competed. My emotions were so high and dropped. And this was like way late at night that I was doing it because it was for, you know, time on the East Coast.
Right.
And I lay down and I fell asleep in the back of the one of the vans, which they could have taken me anywhere. Like, I wouldn't have known. I was just exhausted.
Right.
So I got out. I got back to my hotel, and it was, like, not very long later, I realized I lost my medal.
You lost? Oh, wow.
Yeah. It had slid out of my pocket. Oops. Or whatever. Yes. So I kind of...
They should probably not give the medals to the athletes like right after they compete. Like,
yeah, or somebody else
like send it in the mail, like, or give it to your coach, or...
Yeah, I'm notorious for losing really important stuff. Me too. So definitely not me. I like can give my wallet over and the itinerary and tickets to other people that are more like better at adulting than I am. But I fell asleep and like so immediately I was like, okay, God. All right, I get it. I know I was really pissed off about getting the silver medal, but if you just bring it back, I swear to God, I'll be grateful. I swear. And so, like, not long after that, like, shortly, I got a phone call, and the cab driver, he brought it back, and he gave it to...
Oh, it was in the cab.
Yes. I'd fallen asleep, and it slid out, and it slid between, it slid behind the seat.
So, unbelievable.
Yeah, but I was like, I was so...
Man, that would have been a nice fine for the next driver. Oh, just got my silver medals from the Olympic.
No doubt. Olympic Games. I was like super happy that that was a great person who came and returned it to me. But even then, I just knew, I was like, okay, you could have come away empty-handed. I know that you trained and that, you know, I wanted the gold, and I came so freaking close. I was 1 point off, you know?
Right.
But it taught me that, you know, like... It really did. Like, it's stupid. We say this to kids all the time. Like, just do your best, your absolute best, and you won't regret it.
Right.
And it's the truth. Like,
yeah, I believe that. I mean, and there's a bunch of lessons you learn throughout life. There's all these cliche things you hear, like, you know, follow your heart, and the money will come, and you can do anything you put your mind to, and, you know, on and on and on. There's, like, these things that you hear from people saying that are a lot of times accomplished people that are saying them, but you've heard them over and over again. But a lot of that suffering is true. So let's rewind back and hear the interesting part of how the heck you got to this place anyways where you're in a spot to be the first ever to do something that is, you know, so iconic and so important to the U.S. and to the world and to yourself and your, you know, everyone around you. But you came from very humble beginnings, and no one really knows this kind of the full story of Sarah's. You know, one of the reasons we're doing this podcast is because, you know, I spent some time on this last training camp and we got to know each other a little bit more, and I'm thinking, man, your story is incredible. And, you know, I think it'll help a lot of people to kind of hear what you come from and, you know, what the journey's been like to go from somebody, and before we started this, you said, I despise people that feel sorry for themselves, which is such a rare thing in this world. You're full of crybabies and excuse this and poor me and this and that. I want to hear a little bit about your story of what it was like growing up and what drove you to be, you know, a world champ and an Olympic athlete and one of the best fighters for the females on the planet. Like, where were your beginnings like?
So, I grew up, you know, like really poor.
Where were you? You said North Carolina?
So I was born in DC and my parents we've lived a lot of different places in Maryland and Pennsylvania. Both my parents are from Pennsylvania, but my dad did a lot of construction in Maryland. So he made good money there, and he worked for Miller and Long, and it was just, but Maryland was extremely expensive place to live. So, a lot of times too, like if I moved a lot and I moved schools a ton, is because we were just poor. So we would get evicted from places or, you know.
And this is your mom, your dad, brother?
My brother and my sister.
And your sister. And how old's your sister?
So my sister's 5 years older than me. So right now she's 42. My brother was 3 years older than me.
Okay.
So I'm the baby.
Gotcha. And we'll get into that. Brother is since deceased, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. So you're going from place to place. Your dad's working construction. What's your mom up to?
My mom, so she worked jobs before we were born, but basically whenever she had us, she would do like different, she would watch us and she would babysit. So she was more of a stay-at-home mom.
Gotcha.
But she was the first woman crane operator in the United States.
Really?
Yeah.
So. You guys all sorts of firsts in your family.
I know. It's the Italian women.
That's it. Yeah. My mom's Italian.
My mom raised me as women can do anything men can do, only better. So, of course, if I went to wrestling, I was like, I'm going to beat you. I don't care. I was just delusional about it.
So. Right. So, obviously, money isn't everything, and you had a family. Your family's working, at least. You know, what kind of obstacles did you go through as a kid aside from having money? You guys have a family. There's three kids and two parents, and you're moving around. Was it all, you know, peachy keen, or what was it like?
No. So as far as like, you know, like love in my family, that was never lacking, you know,
right.
But I haven't talked about this very much. I've just been really selective because I already have so much of my life that is kind of out there and for people, you know, to know like the most tragic things. But since I was 4 years old, like some of my earliest memories are my parents were addicted to heroin, and sometimes not even just that. Like sometimes if they weren't doing heroin, they were like alcoholics. Like they would just kind of transfer to different drugs, you know?
I mean, that's a heavy thing. Heroin's supposed to be one of the most addictive drugs and damaging drugs. Were you aware of this growing up, or at what point did you become aware that your parents had an issue with like heavy drugs? I mean, is that?
Yeah. So, usually if you're around these kind of situations, like you pick up on something is different, like a lot quicker. So I remember at 9 years old, I asked my mom, I'm like, I just put it together. I was like, are you guys like doing drugs? Cause I remember at the time.
You were nine at the time?
I was nine. And
how old is your daughter now?
She's 8. She's about to turn 9.
Wow, that's crazy.
I know.
Well, I could see her calling you out too, though.
Yeah,
she's super smart. Yeah,
she is. She's letting me get away with crap.
Yeah.
But I just knew something was different about my family, and then like we were living in a hotel because we'd gotten evicted, so we were just living in a hotel, which we consequently got kicked out of the hotel also. But
isn't that expensive? How do you live in a hotel?
You deal drugs.
Yeah, okay.
So if you're addicted to drugs, you usually deal drugs in order to pay for it. And so, like, yeah.
Wow.
But so they worked out like in the like efficiency rate, you know, and you're paying week by week rather than like every single day, okay. $100 a night. But my parents had spent a lot. They'd spent a lot of time in the bathroom, you know, like, and so I was like,
privacy. Even, if you're living in a yeah. motel, they're probably doing all sorts of stuff in there.
So that's what I thought. I was like, either my parents are in the bathroom having sex or they're doing drugs. Like,
yeah.
At 9 years old, I was like, I picked up on it. But so having an older brother and older sister too, they expose you to everything a lot sooner. Like so as they start to figure out stuff, you yeah. overhear these conversations too. So I'm sure that it wasn't just only my idea, but I would have found out. So my dad is like ridiculously honest. So if I'd have come to him and I'd have said, are you and mom doing drugs? Even at 9, he would have been like, yes, we are, Sarah. Like he just would have told me because he has a lot of flaws and he definitely was addicted to drugs, but honesty was not one of them.
That's interesting.
I know. But so my mom was different though. My mom, she's the kind of woman that could steal your shoes from you and sell it back to you and make you think you got a deal.
Like, you're a slick talker, huh?
Yes, yes. And so, you know, good liar, good, I mean, she's very slick. And so she was like—
Are they still alive, your parents?
Yeah.
Yeah?
They live in Pennsylvania.
Gotcha.
In Lock Haven. That's where like most of my family's from.
Huh.
But so she was like, no, no, honey. And I'm like, I was still pretty naive, you know? So I was like, oh, okay, good. Thank yeah. God, you know? So did not question that I was moving schools and, you know, all over the place and living with other people and, you know, how much money my dad made. He was a foreman for Miller and Long. He made great money. That's another thing, too.
Really?
Yes. So I'm telling you, like, my dad was addicted to drugs and never missed work. Extremely hard worker. Like,
yeah, he's a functioning addict.
Yeah. My mom was the wild card. My mom, when she became addicted, my mom's overdosed like 3 different times.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Like near death?
Like 100% near death.
Wow, what was that like?
That's actually one of the earliest memories I have. Like, I was like 6 years old and we were carrying her out to the van to like take her to the hospital because she'd OD'd.
Jeez, that's nuts.
I know. So, like, the thing is that when you're young and you grow up and this is the only thing you've ever known, you really don't, like, you don't know anything different until you're older.
Right.
So you start to see other families and stuff like that. So you can, essentially, when kids are young, you can normalize anything, you know?
Yeah.
Even, you know, so, like, I was just a very easy kid, you know, pretty happy kid, quiet, read books, you know? And so I really wasn't that hard to deal with until I hit puberty. And at the same time, I learned what was really going on with my parents.
Yeah.
And I,
so when you're having this, you're growing up, cause we didn't have a lot of money growing up. My dad, you know, my parents split when I was in kindergarten and, you know, my mom's doing modeling, working at Nordstrom and has a little apartment downtown. And my dad's, you know, one time he had a motorhome and we'd just park at his buddy's house and we'd go in the summer, he'd park us by a pond and we'd go fishing and he would work all day. Like, you know, it's all relative when it comes to money and your life. It's just, that's just your life.
Yeah,
you know, you're just
yeah.
doing your thing. I mean, was it any kind of normalcy that went from, instead of jumping around from home to home and living in motels and mom ODing and stuff like that, to where it kind of settled out and you're like, all right, this is home for us?
No. I can even, like, remember in high school, there was, like, a 6-month chunk of time that we lived in a trailer with, like, no electricity.
Huh.
Like, I mean, like,
How old were you then?
That was when I was, like, 16 or 17.
Huh.
Like, even once I got to like 14,
man, that must have been hard being a high school kid, living like that and going to, you know.
I think that it was easier for me than my brother and sister because it's really strange, but I've always had like a part of me that didn't care what people thought.
Yeah,
like I would go in and pay for things with food stamps, and I wasn't even slightly embarrassed. Like I still shop at thrift stores.
Yeah,
I don't give a crap. If I had $10 million in the bank, I would be at thrift stores and be like, I got this for $1.
Yeah.
I just, I think when I was really young, I learned that I was happy. And so that definitively told me that I do not need money to be happy.
Yeah.
I can just be happy.
I like that. So, yeah.
And I learned it without it. And so, like, I've never felt this, you know, tremendous drive to make money, but I do have a tremendous drive to do what makes me happy. And right. that just happens to bring money. Like, even with wrestling, I just did it because I loved it. It wasn't in the Olympics.
Yeah, we all had to.
Yeah, yeah.
There wasn't anything.
There still really isn't. Right. If you're the top of the food chain returning medalist, then you are getting paid to do what you do. But everybody else is still like, their family is struggling.
Yeah.
So they can pursue their dreams. And yeah. so it's a beautiful thing. I think it keeps like a lot of corruption out of it. It keeps us so poor that, you know, most people don't cheat at it.
Yeah.
Like, you can't really invest that much money into performance-enhancing drugs, you know. And there's, like, a kind of honor in wrestling to never have that, you know.
Yeah. It's a battle of attrition, like.
Yeah. It's like, oh, I mean, I like to think you're such a pussy that you need to take something else. Like,
yeah.
We're doing 2 days, and we're killing ourselves naturally, and you got to take something. Like,
yeah.
It's a sign of weakness in wrestling.
Yeah. I agree with that. So that's – so – that being said, you know, at this point you're 16. You guys, your brother and sister, what are they gonna do? Did they take the same track as far as becoming athletes, or are they getting into trouble? I mean, I feel like you were pretty straight and narrow.
Yeah.
Or did you have a wild phase?
I did have a wild phase.
Did you? What was that like?
Getting pretty crazy. Wild. So. When I was 12 years old, I started smoking pot, and I did that for like 2 years until I started wrestling, and then all the running and wrestling and how hard wrestling was, I was like, one of these has to go. Like, I literally cannot keep smoking weed. I'm dying. My lungs are dying. And I smoke cigarettes, too.
You smoke cigarettes?
Yes.
Oh, like, my. I've never years. Had a cigarette.
Yeah, they're terrible. They're absolutely terrible. So... luckily, by just a whim, I really liked wrestling a lot. And it's not completely a whim. I was told, you'll quit wrestling. Like, I was told that I was never going to be able to do it. So I was like, fuck you. You know,
let me tell you that.
That stubbornness inside of me, I was like, I'm not quitting. So I had to quit smoking and,
yeah, you poor thing. You had to quit smoking?
I know. Well, even
cigarettes? I'm just trying to imagine you smoking cigarettes right now with a raspy voice.
I was 14 the first time I tripped on acid.
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
The first time. How many times did you trip on acid? There's a certain amount of times you tripped on acid before you're supposed to be
certifiably
insane, which I think may be false.
I'm past that.
It's all coming together now.
But it helped me because I'm kind of delusional in my sports. And so I'm like, I don't care what's happened. I don't care if I got hurt. I don't care if I got lost. I don't care what's happened. I'm going to do it. And like, it's. So maybe it works for me.
Were your brother and sister part of this, like, showing you the...
Yes, that's exactly why. Like, I had a sister that was 5 years older and a brother that was 3 years older. So as they were getting into things, I just kind of followed in their footsteps. Now, I will say this, though. I've never done any, like, addictive drugs. So I wouldn't do anything that my parents had been addicted to. Because even then, when I was younger, I knew... if I went down that rabbit hole, I would never recover. Like, I know that...
Really?
Yeah. Addiction...
You were that self-aware? You think you just overthought this and now you think you're self-aware? Or
No,
thinking that?
Nope. I was extreme... Okay, so, like, one thing that I've been able to do my whole life is look at other people's mistakes and learn from them. I didn't have to experience it myself, which has saved me because addiction is so unbelievably hard to come back from. Like, even my parents were screwing up and making bad decisions... they tried so many times to quit. You know, I watched my dad go through withdrawals from heroin. He cut it cold turkey. And for 2 weeks, like, he was just in bed, unbelievably sick.
Wow.
And the kind of willpower to stop that addictive of a drug, you know, but they knew it was wrong. They just were too, it just had its claws in them too deep.
Right.
So they loved us. They wanted to do better. They just weren't able to, weren't strong enough. You know?
That's a trip. So, your sister, did that affect her?
Yeah, she moved out when she was 17, and she got like a lot more into partying. Like, she doesn't do anything now. She's a mother. She has 2 kids, but she struggled with that. Like, for a really long time.
She's
gonna
be okay
time.
With you talking about this?
Yeah, she's
okay.
Okay. She knows. I mean, like, she's had to come out. Like, she's gone to different like recovery groups and stuff like that. So she's had to come to terms with this. because she, you know, she didn't want this to affect her children.
Right.
So, like.
So, you're doing acid, smoking cigarettes.
Smoking weed.
Yeah. Getting down with dudes probably on occasion.
No, actually, I was really, really strict with that too, because I was always around guys.
Yeah.
So I heard how guys talked about girls. I'm like, not me, bitches. Like, you're not going to talk about me like that. So even around wrestlers, I was like,
I heard the Olympic Village is like a meat market.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, totally, it's like they give out condoms. Market. It is like, okay, so listen, like, it's like the most intense amount. It's like, you know, with your title fights, the most intense amount of pressure ever, you know, and it doesn't matter how you do, once that pressure is lifted, but take like thousands of athletes in that same, like everybody. Yeah, it's just a wants to,
big
like,
celebration.
Yes, because.
Get their rocks off.
Yeah, it's. If nothing else, you're not under that crushing weight anymore.
Right.
You know? So, like, you can breathe a sigh of relief. You did the best you could. No matter how you came out, you want to be, you're around other people who are like ecstatic, you know, like everybody right. is. So it was really tough too when we were there, like other sports were like finishing before us and you could see the relief in their face. And like, you know, we're all still like, okay, dude, we still have, you know, this much to go. Like,
yeah.
I don't even want to look at you. Blinders on, stay focused, you know?
Yeah.
Don't even think about that finish line.
That's awesome. That must have been fun for the guys that took guys and girls that took advantage of it.
I know. I didn't. I had a boyfriend.
That's funny.
But I wonder how many Olympian kids came out of that.
I'm sure quite a bit.
Yeah.
That's quite the breeding ground for the future stars of America.
Eugenics.
And just all over the world. There's probably some hybrid babies out there from the Olympic Games.
I know.
They should do a documentary on that.
Don't think I haven't thought Spawns. About selling eggs. I'm like, look at this.
All right, listen up, folks. Sarah's still considering selling her eggs, Olympic eggs.
And I have a master's degree. I'll go back and get my PhD.
Master's degree. We have proof of one child that she has already who's phenomenal. You can take a gander at the goods. And she's done a little bit of heroin. Not heroin, a little bit of acid.
Yeah.
Smoke some cigarettes, smoke some weed, but got that all out of her system by the time she was young. So if you're looking for some Italian-ish, Olympic-level wrestling-ish fighter eggs.
Around puberty, they might be quite unstable.
But we're going to put them out on the black market, so look for her social media for the details on that. But okay, so you've got your brother... Your brother and your sister, and so who got you into wrestling? Is it your brother, right? Is that...
Yeah. So nobody got me into wrestling as much. I just grown up around wrestling for, you know, since I was like 3 years old. So I'd always been around wrestling. Is it still recording or no?
It doesn't need to be, though.
Okay.
Because, go ahead.
So, but I grew up around it, and he had wrestled since he was 6 years old, and all the way through until 11, he got hit by a car, and he broke both of his legs and, like, crushed his hip, and they never thought he'd walk again.
Your brother?
Yes. He was hit by a Jeep. He was crossing the road on his bicycle, and it hit him so hard, he went completely over the Jeep and hit his head on the other side on the road. Yeah, yes. So, he did eventually wrestle again. It took like a few years though, but he couldn't bend his knees all the way, which is really tough for referee's position. So he struggled with that, but my brother's had like a couple of like near death experiences, but that was one of them. And so he stopped wrestling, and right about not long after he had stopped wrestling, is whenever I became interested in just doing sports in general. So I had gone up until 14. I'd never done any sports, except I cheerleaded 1 year when I was 8.
Why are you so embarrassed about that? Not your thing?
No, it wasn't for me. I did it because my older sister was on the cheerleading team, and it wasn't for me. So I did it for just 1 year, and then I was like, okay.
That's... So your brother had many near death experiences, you're saying?
Yeah, like...
Just being a wild kid, kind of aggressive.
Well, he got hit by a car whenever he was 11. And then when he was 16, he was at a party and he got jumped. And he got beaten so bad. Like, they took a, you know, those old metal weights that you put in a pillowcase?
Yeah.
Yeah, the old metal weights that used to hold on weights. The ones that you screw in. Somebody put that in a pillowcase. Came in, and he was just playing cards. Something had happened downstairs. These guys got kicked out of a party. They came back upstairs with other people, hit him in the back of the head so hard. He got 57 stitches on the inside and outside of his head.
Oh, my gosh.
They were, like, his face, his, like, lip was swollen, like, past his nose because they were kicking his head and hitting it against the wall. I mean, he just got the living hell beat out of him.
That's
crazy.
So it's
another time that he narrowly escaped death, you know. He didn't even know anything was even going on. Like, they were just at a party playing cards. And so,
I mean, there's no backstory to that. They were just,
so whatever. No, there's no, like, they weren't actually specifically going after him.
Oh.
They were just at it was my sister's boyfriend's house. They were in the downstairs. They got kicked out of the party, and they just came back to, like, completely destroy shit. But they came in the front door, you know, and nobody even knew what had gone on downstairs. They just started jumping other people, too. It wasn't specifically him.
That's so nuts.
I know. He got, like, the really, really terrible end of the deal on that one.
So he was the first wrestler in the family.
Yeah.
And then that's what got you into it. How old were you when you started wrestling?
14. Ninth grade year.
Wow, ninth grade. So ninth grade and then into the Olympics winning a silver medal. That's pretty friggin' awesome.
Yeah, 10
years.
You said
the girl you went against was wrestling since she was 3?
Yeah, she is and a sister. And her sister was an Olympic silver medalist for twice. And they both started when they were 3 years old. And I think that in China and Japan, like, they involved their kids in sports at a very young age, and she was in wrestling, and she'd been doing it. I'm not exactly sure how old she was when she wrestled me. I think that she was maybe like 4 years younger than me.
Huh.
So she'd been doing it for like 17 years.
That's crazy.
I know.
So, did you know right away this is a sport for you? You started excelling at it. Like, what was it about wrestling that, like, drew you in and was like, okay, this is my thing? It takes a special person to like wrestling.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so, like, not something you want to just throw your kid into. It's
from doing no sports whatsoever and partying and smoking cigarettes. No,
it's like, yeah.
You just want to, like, I think I'm going to wrestle. Just, you know, decide to do it. Part of it came, I didn't like it right away.
Would you smoke a cigarette just so I can see what it looks like?
No. I've smoked a fake one. I'm like,
trying to imagine this. This would be,
like a little hoodlum. I just did, you know, stupid hoodlum stuff.
You're just hanging out with your
friend,
your friends doing hood rat shit?
Yes, pretty much. Like, I just would stay out and I was drinking all the time, you know, like anytime we could get alcohol. I got in trouble and had to go because I jumped on a train and I accidentally hit the emergency brake, so it stopped, and then I took off and just stupid stuff of, like, sneaking out at night and, you know, vandalizing things, just being a menace.
You're a mess.
I know. But I always liked hide.
Does Bella know this? Does your daughter know about this?
No, please don't show her this.
She's going to have to hear about this so she can know how great she is.
But, yeah, I was like, I just, like, even, like, Chad, my boyfriend, was like, you know, I was like, why are you like this? He's like, I don't know. Why are you like that? And I was like, I don't know. I had a bad upbringing and poor role models. I have actual excuses why I did this stupid stuff. He had a great family. When he was doing hood rat stuff, like, he had no reason. His parents were super loving and from the, you know, nice suburban house, but he was just a little menace.
He was a little mess himself.
Yeah.
And now, one of the big things, I'm not sure how public this is, but your brother passed away, and it was actually murder.
Yeah.
I was shocked when you told me that and kind of the background of it and kind of how it affected or how at home you are or how comfortable you are with the conversation. But, I mean, that must have been super hard. I know you said you looked up to your brother quite a bit. Yeah. He's the one that got you into wrestling, something that is a massive part of your life. You guys are pretty close.
Yeah. We were, so growing up, it's like any sibling relationship. Like, I was basically, like, he just beat the crap out of me, you know? Like, and I couldn't outrun him, so I, you know. So we had, like, a I always like adored him and looked up to him and imitated him and stuff like that. But, you know, he didn't want to bother with a little kid sister and stuff like that. He would just like antagonize me and stuff like that. But when we got, when I went away to college, even actually when I was about like 16 years old, he started to have a different kind of respect for me, you know, like, and he started to treat me different. Cause I, at 13 around there, I just finally had had enough. And like, I stood up to him. I mean, I knew I was going to get my ass beat. But yeah. I was like, I'm not running from you anymore. Like, you're just going to have to beat my ass. I'm just going to, you know, whatever. Like, and there's other times that I kind of like attacked him too. I'm not completely innocent.
But, attacked him. Okay. I can see that more than you smoking cigarettes for some reason.
Well, he had a really great way that like older siblings do of like finding how to like push my buttons to the point where I like kind of lost it, you know, like I would just take it and take it and take it and, you know, and then finally I would just blow up. And so, you know, we had that kind of relationship all throughout growing up. And at 16, you know, like I was working at McDonald's, I was wrestling, I was going to school and like just working my ass off.
Do you love McDonald's? Do you love eating McDonald's?
I'm not sponsored for them, so I'm not going to answer them, no.
Do you like crave McDonald's now?
No, because like after you work there for so long, like you, after you work any restaurant for a while, you kind of just want to pass it up. You get sick of it. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Just even smelling it, you're like, no, I'm not going to do it. You know, I know what the grease bucket smells like. I'm not doing it. But so we became closer then, you know, like with just becoming more adults.
Right.
So we were close, like before.
Before
like,
he passed.
Yeah. Yep. And like that happened my freshman year of college. So.
Oh wow, that was. So how old? So he was what? 22.
21.
21.
And I was 18.
And so what's the story there? How'd that go down?
So I went off to college, and at the end of January, like it was, we were on trimesters, but. It was after Christmas break. I got a call from my sister and she was like, I'm not, you know, this is ridiculous. I'm not hiding this anymore. And she told me, my parents had been hiding from me that my brother had been missing for like 3 weeks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so I was like, I mean, I'm in Minnesota. I'm right. Like super far away. There's nothing I can do. I'm just like kind of reeling with this information. So for like, he was missing for like 2 months. And that's like, I don't know, like people, I guess if you've been in this situation, you can understand, but it's actually harder when somebody is missing and not knowing, like just not knowing
yeah.
is far more painful than
your imagination can go crazy. I'd imagine.
Yeah. Yes. And like, I'd have dreams that like, that we found them, you know, I even had dreams after I learned that he was dead for sure. I'd have dreams where like, we found him and I'm like, oh my God, I'm so happy in the dream. I'm like so happy.
Yeah.
And like, we've been looking for you. Where have you been? You know, and stuff like that. And then I'd wake up to like the reality of him still being missing or not knowledge that he was murdered and I was never going to see him again.
Wow. Yeah. So, I mean, once, how long he was missing for 2 months before they actually figured out that he had been murdered?
Yeah. So, they couldn't find his body. So they didn't know if he had just taken off or whatever. And like, it's a small town in Lock Haven, Pennsylvania. It's like a little, you know, they really weren't very equipped to deal with like a murder. And so they kind of were like, oh, you know, after the first like week or two, they were like, he's just off partying somewhere, you know, and you guys are making a big deal, you know.
Yeah.
And my parents were like, no, he would never do this. Like, he would show up, he would call someone or whatever. But when we, you know, like we knew fairly certain, like going into it that, you know, he had been murdered. And so, it wasn't until the 2 months, like a jogger was passing by a wooded area and it was a place where the guys who had murdered him, like it was they were football players for Lock Haven.
Oh, they were?
For the university. Yeah.
Oh, wow. The murderers were?
Yeah. Because one of the murderers, his name is Fabian Smart. He was from Philadelphia and he was he grew up like really terrible and murders happen all the time in Philadelphia. He literally said, like in his testimony, he didn't understand what the McMahon family was making such a big deal about, you know? He didn't understand why we were making such a big deal because murder was so common.
Wow.
Unsolved murder in Philadelphia is so common that's kind of how he dealt with a problem. My brother was a problem. He solved it. But this guy, he's a sociopath, you know?
Obviously, like, yeah.
Yeah, he just doesn't...
Fabian Smart, that's kind of a cool name, but he sounds like a friggin' idiot, huh?
Like, yeah, now he's in life in prison, so not too bad.
For that, mm-hmm. Was he in it alone?
So he asked his cousin, Willie, to bring him a gun from Philadelphia. Uh-huh. Like, that guy wasn't a football player. And there was two other guys that once... They were kind of down for, like, beating my brother up and jumping him. But once they realized what Fabian had planned to do, they're like, stop the car. They got out, you know. Like, right. They didn't want any part of it. And so I think that his cousin testified and got, like, a reduced sentence.
Right.
And because it was Fabian that really committed it and had the whole plan. And I think he was more of, like, an accomplice.
Huh. That's a trip. So... Man, that's some pretty heavy shit. So your brother had some sort of beef with him, and every time he saw him, he was like,
yeah.
He's fucking this dude up.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and like, was your brother a big guy?
So I think he was probably about like 190, maybe like a little under 6 foot.
Yeah.
But he wrestled since he was six.
Yeah.
You know, Italian genetics, built like a freaking Greek god, just strong as hell. Like,
yeah.
He was like, he had abs when he was like, you know, 5 years old. I can find old wrestling pictures of him, and he has like a total six pack, like my daughter.
Yeah.
And when he was like 11, I was like, my brother has a freaking mustache at 11. This is ridiculous, you know, like, so genetically gifted when it came to like strength and power.
Right.
So he, you know, like, he was a good fighter. So. It was, you know.
They got in this. They got. It was a constant thing. He was.
Yeah.
You seen this guy?
My brother beat him up once. That guy was gonna get back at him, so he got two guys to come try to jump him and another guy try to jump my brother. My brother beat up both the guys. They saw they you know, it's a small town, so there's only so many places you can party. Saw him at a bar. My brother like knocked him out with one punch. I mean, he was just like, it was like, you know, at least six different times that they
had it, got into it.
Yeah, my brother beat him up. So like. The guy's next step was like, not, he just wasn't going to keep taking it like that, you know?
So that had been a life-changing event for you, maybe. Well, like, how do you deal with that and then continue on your path of, I mean, at this point, and I can always appreciate this in people, when things aren't perfect, but you choose to do the right thing. You choose to make something better out of your life. You choose to, like, not let anything stop you. This is obviously one of those cases where you had the cards stacked against you with loving but super dysfunctional family. You know, bad influences which you partook in and then decided to change in a different direction.
I went to his funeral. 1 week before, I rode out to our national tournament.
Oh, wow.
Like, I had to tell my coach, like, hey, I have to go home. I hadn't even told anybody. I kept it completely secret, except, like, my two teammates knew.
Yeah.
That I had to go to my brother's funeral, and then a week later, or it was, like, a week and a half later, compete in our national tournament, like, the U.S. Open.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So, just let it slide by. And I know that... I heard a story about Arnold Schwarzenegger where his father had died and he was getting ready for the Mr. Olympia and his mom wanted him to come home to Austria and be part of the funeral and everything, and he just called and he was like, Mom, I love Dad, but I'm focusing on my shit and he's dead. Like, that was his mentality, you know? Which, you know, it's cold, but on some level, like...
Mine was a little bit different mentality than that.
Like, yeah, well, obviously. Yeah.
I really thought, like, especially, so I had known, like, as my brother and I had grown a lot closer together, he didn't say it to me because I'm his little sister. So all he did was, like, pick on me for things I did wrong in wrestling. But I knew with other people when he spoke to them, like, he was really proud of what I'd done, you know, like, and how far I was going. And I was going to college and I had a scholarship to wrestle, you know, like, and I knew that, like, I wasn't going to sabotage something that he was really proud of me for doing, you know? And so, like, for the next couple years, I had, like, a lot of, I didn't deal with it, like, intelligently, you know, like I dealt with it the way an 18-year-old dealing with a really crappy situation would, which means I was like super angry and a workaholic.
Yeah.
So I like threw myself into college.
That's a better alternative.
Yeah. Yep. Wrestling in college just exhausted me. I just ran myself ragged, and I had a lot of great, like, productive years because of it, you know. Yeah. Although it probably mentally wasn't good, because I would like daydream about torturing the people that my brother, you know, had been murdered by. And it took a long time for me to deal with these, like, you know, ripped off feelings and like pain, you know, of knowing that, you know, just everything involved with it. But I was like, you know, I'm a little tough girl, so I'm gonna bury it and stuff it down real deep, and I'm just gonna keep forging ahead, you know, and be strong. And then I also had my family to think about, like my parents were, you know,
you're probably the crown jewel of the family at this point, where everyone's rooting for you and you're bringing joy and pride and everything and hope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Absolutely. So my wrestling, like, I love to do it, thankfully, but it really became a source of like my parents finding some kind of like happiness in life that really, you know, was very hard to find at those points.
Yeah. Yeah, I've had some life experiences, like, you know, stuff with my brother that's gone down, and then my sister in an accident, and, you know, little things here and there that aren't quite as comparable as that. But I mean, you choose one way or another.
Yeah,
so what did that, you know, obviously we know the story after that. You go on to be a great wrestler in college, then you go on to be in the Olympics. Then you go on to become a professional fighter, and you fought at the highest level and are still fighting at the highest level. But, and I know you from, you know, more so in the last, you know, 6 months than I ever have before. But, you know, the obvious pride and joy of your life right now is your daughter, Bella.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what are the lessons that you've learned, you know, that are going to be a massive part of how you bring your daughter up? What are some of the things that that you've taken that you want to implement in her? I know my mom was like super forward, like she wanted us to try all these different things. She wanted us to play the violin and try this and try that and see if we could sing and like testing the waters.
Yeah.
What are some of the things that you try to implement as a mother? Like, what are some of the most important values that you try to implement on your daughter?
So what I really praise with her and what I really focus on is not results, you know, or like she is smart and she's really adorable, but I don't think that it's very good to like, to say, oh, you're smart or, oh, you're pretty. Cause I don't want her to place the most value in that. So when she does something, I'm like, wow, you must have worked really hard, you know, like I praise her effort.
Yeah.
You know, and when when she doesn't get something, I'm like, man, look at you. Look at how long and determined you were to do that. I think that if you stick with this problem, I think you'll solve it, you know? And so I teach her there's two things in life. Either you get something right away, or you drill something, learn something, work at it and persist, and then you get it.
Yeah.
So for her, she doesn't even have the option of like not having something happen.
Right.
It's either it happens right away, you just luck out and you're good at it, or you work at it and then you're good at it.
Right.
So like that's one of the things I want her to know. Empathy, you know, like I'm really big on her trying to put herself in other people's shoes and imagine how she would want to be treated, imagine how she would want to be talked to, like even animals, like everything has a voice, and for her to be fair and respectful towards everything.
Yeah.
And so like, because a lot of times it's very easy for your kids to really center on themselves and forget that other people have feelings and stuff like that. So just a very good sense of fairness and then honesty. Like my dad passed it down to me. I pass it down to my daughter. Honesty, even if it harms you, like I will tell, I'll say anything exactly how it is, even if it's to my detriment. Because I honor truth that much. So
if your daughter asks you, you're going to tell her everything under the sun about what you've done?
Yeah.
Is there a part of you that
I will say, there is a caveat. I will only tell her age-appropriate things.
Obviously.
So, like, that's all it is. Like, if she asks me something and I'm like, honey, when you're a little bit older, I'll talk to you about it. You know? Like, that's – so I either give her the truth or I delay it.
Right. And Yeah, that makes sense. And what do you think as far as all these different lessons that you've learned, the hard stuff that you've talked about, even today you've talked about a little bit, is there a plan to eventually unfold that stuff to her? Do you think it's like, doesn't really need to know?
No, I'll tell her. Truthfully, I think that the best lessons you learn for most people are ones you experience yourself. Yeah. So I can tell you everything, but one thing I learned through going through some super difficult experiences is that things are not fair. You're not going to get an even distribution of stuff. Like, people think, like, because I've been through so much, that, like, oh, well, like, in their mind, they're like, well, you've been through that. And they kind of subconsciously think that because I survived that stuff and I'm doing well, that the rest of my life is going to be easier. And I'm like, life is under no means to do that.
Yeah, there's going to be all sorts of crap that happens, unfortunately.
Everything that is possible could happen to me. I could get paralyzed. I could get raped. I could get, you know, a leg chopped off by, you know, freaking bitten off by a shark. Anything that's humanly possible can happen. And that's what the biggest things that, like, my life has taught me is that please just understand the real rules of the game.
Yeah.
The real rules, not the movie version, not the fairy tale version.
Where real rules are anything goes.
Anything. And you better be able to deal with it, because as far as we know, we get one life. You know, yeah. I'm pulling for reincarnation. I kind of want to come back as a few different animals.
Which animal?
A pig.
Yeah. All right.
You know why?
Because they taste so good.
They have 30-minute orgasms. Isn't that nuts?
Really?
30 freaking minutes. Yes.
Damn, I want to be a pig too.
Chad said dolphin because they experience pleasure like sexually like humans do.
Yeah. How about bonobo monkeys? They just, everything they do is they just hump everything.
Well, that might be good.
That's how they greet each other, say hello. And
someone to be appropriate.
That might be cool.
There's a few people I have to throw poop at. But
a pig. 30-minute orgasms. You sure?
Yeah, look it up.
I'm Googling that.
You should Google it. But no, so like you have to know the rules of life and you get one. So whatever you get, like, you have to play the hand you're dealt. You don't know. You don't know how anything is going to go. You could walk out of here tomorrow, play a lottery ticket, and be a billionaire and have, like, the most money and multiply that, and your children's could be great. Who knows? And that could be great, or it could be disastrous. You don't know how the other people in your life are going to react to that. There's so many lottery winners, 9 out of 10, who go bankrupt, lose their family, lose their friends because of winning the lottery.
Yeah, I saw the guy that won the lottery, and he ate himself into oblivion, got so obese, and then he became like a hoarder, didn't leave his couch, and they had to, like, I think, like, cut him out of his house or something, and he went broke. So
you take somebody else and you can put them in, like, trying circumstances, and I think it's a very, like, natural human nature to, like, if the challenges aren't too overwhelming, to work and fight and claw your way back out.
Right.
You know, like, now if they're, like, unbelievably, you know, difficult, like Holocaust victims and, you know, like, you might be too traumatized to ever, you know, make it back to the other
side. There can be mental, like, some mental instability that happens from some things, obviously, but if you're able-bodied, able-mind, you know, you have a chance.
Yeah, you can turn anything around. And how one of my favorite quotes, there is no reality, only perception.
Yeah.
So how you perceive everything, I don't perceive that to be a stumbling block the way I was raised. It made me independent. It meant my parents weren't focusing so much on my sports that became like helicopter parents that drove me. I drove myself. Right. So all of my will came internally, which served me. But like, I'm resourceful. I can be, whether I have money or don't have money, I'm just as happy. Like,
Content.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So absolutely.
Different things in life. So you choose it.
Right. Well, that's right. So Sarah, she scared us a little bit. She inspired us. Let yourself, you know, open up about some stuff that people may not have known. You also Clifford Clavin'd us with some useless knowledge about pigs orgasming and whatnot. You have a beautiful daughter and you got a great career that's still cooking. What's next? I know you're in love with your boy Chad, who's an amazing jiu-jitsu player. There are going to be some more Little McMahons, some little alpha female or males
yes,
in the future.
I want that. I'm not exactly sure when, yeah. But yes.
That is still something that you want in the cards?
Yes. So I want to have a child. I want to fight. And I want to now start like angling to give back.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, yeah, you talked a little bit about wanting to do some speeches, some motivational talks, which I think what an amazing platform you have and a great story. Hopefully you're working on a book. You writing a book or yeah?
I am. It's in the early stages, so I have to, I'm not exactly a writer, but I can write like the bare bones, but I have to find somebody who can edit it and, you know, put it together in a way that, you know, is the best way to tell the story.
Yeah, absolutely. And look forward to seeing that. And if I can help out any way, I will on any of these fronts, you know, getting your fight career going. We're already on that front with the speeches. And then I can maybe try to hook up with some of the book folks. But hey, guys, I hope you enjoyed that. That was a little insight to Sarah McMahon. Eternal optimist. She despises people that make excuses and feel sorry for themselves. And you've heard what she's gone through. And that's just kind of scratching the surface. That was 1 hour. Thanks for tuning in to the CaliCast. It's another one in the bank. And Sarah, we look forward to seeing the little babies, seeing the book, seeing you get the world championship and all the other stuff that comes at you.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yep.